Gaudiya Vaishnavinda ki, Nama Chaya Shri Haridas Thakur ki, Prem Se Gaur Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasudeva Gaura Bhaktavinda ki, Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gopi Gopinath Shamakund Radhakund Giri Govardhan Ki Shri Vrindavan Dham Ki Shri Mayapur Dham Ki Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Gangamaya Ki Yamunamaya Ki Tulsi Deva Ki Bhakti Deva Ki Samaveda Bhakti Vrinda Ki Go Premanandi. All glories the assembled devotees. All glories the assembled devotees. All glories the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. A reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 14, The Story of King Vena. Text 1. Maitreya Uvacha. Brigvarayaste Munayo. Lokanam Shimadashina. Goptaya Sativai Nirnam. Pasyanta Pasu Samyatam. Maitreya Uvacha. Brigvarayastu Munayo. Lokanam Shemadashina. Goptaya Sativai Nirnam. Pasyanta Pasu Samyatam. Maitreya Uvacha. Brigvarayaste Munayo. Lokanam Shemadashina. Goptaya Sativai Nirnam. Pasyanta Pasu Samyatam. Maitreya Uvacha. Asyanta Pasu Samyutta. Ladies. Maitreya Uvacha.
The great sage Maitreya said,
Bhrigu Adya, headed by Bhrigu, Te, all of them, Munaya, the great sages, Lokanam, of the people, Shema Darshana, who always aspire for the welfare, Goptari, the king, Asati, being absent, Vai, certainly, Nirnam, of all the citizens, Pasyanta, having understood, Pasu Samyatam, existence on the level of the animals. Translation. The great sage Maitreya continued, O great hero Vidura, the great sages headed by Bhrigu were always thinking of the welfare of the people in general. When they saw that in the absence of King Anga there was no one to protect the interests of the people, they understood that without a ruler the people would become independent and non-regulated. Please repeat. The great sage Maitreya continued. O great hero Vidura, the great sages, headed by Bhrigu, were always thinking of the welfare of the people in general. When they saw that in the absence of King Anga, there was no one to protect the interests of the people, they understood that without a ruler, the people would become independent and non-regulated. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. In this verse, the significant word is Shema Darshana, which refers to those who are always looking after the welfare of the people in general. All the great sages, headed by Bhrigu, were always thinking of how to elevate all the people of the universe to the spiritual platform. Indeed, they advised the kings of every planet to rule the people with that ultimate goal of life in mind. The great sages used to advise the head of state, or the king, and he used to rule the populace in accordance with their instruction. After the disappearance of King Anga, there was no one to follow the instructions of the great sages. Consequently, all the citizens became unruly, so much so that they could be compared to animals. As described in Bhagavad Gita 4.13, human society must be divided into four orders according to quality and work. In every society, there must be an intelligent class, administrative class, productive class, and worker class. In modern democracy, these scientific divisions are turned topsy-turvy, and by vote, sudras or workers are chosen for administrative posts. Having no knowledge of the ultimate goal of life, such persons whimsically enact laws without knowledge of life's purpose. The result is that no one is happy. Translation again. The great sage Maitreya continued, O great hero Vidura, the great sages headed by Bhrigu were always thinking of the welfare of the people in general. When they saw that in the absence of King Anga, there was no one to protect the interests of the people, they understood that without a ruler, the people would become independent and non-regulated. Om Majanatam Randasha Gananjanaya Shilakaya Chakshur Unmulikam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manodishnam Stapitam Yena Putale Svayadu Bhagadama Yandadati Swabhantika Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nichananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. There's elections taking place in West Bengal at the moment.
Actually, they're not taking place right now, but they're taking place, or the voting is taking place very soon. I can't make the microphone louder. I can speak louder, of course. Not usually a complaint. Okay. The microphone has to actually touch your skin, which is an interesting sensation. There's an election campaign taking place in West Bengal at the moment, and the voting will take place, I think, on the 23rd of February in this district. And of course, the Bhagwatam seat should not be used as a political platform, but I urge you all not to vote. Anyway, so on the basis of Srimad Bhagwatam, by the way, and what Prabhupada is saying in the purport, that I'm not particularly commenting on what is his name, Buddhadev Bhattacharya or Mamanta Banerjee. So I won't say that they're sudras, but certainly Prabhupada is indicating that most of them are sudras in this Kali Yuga. But it's just interesting that Prabhupada says, and he says this, this is such a common thing that Prabhupada says when he, in the first line of his purports, in many, many places in the Bhagavatam, he will say, in this verse, the word, or the words, and then he'll give you the words and say, they are most significant. It's actually quite a common thing that Prabhupada does. So in this purport, he says, in this verse, the significant word is Shema Darshina, which means those who are always looking after the welfare of the people in general. When I read that this morning, I thought to myself, wow, what a difficult thing to do, you know. I mean, it's kind of easy to at least want to look after our own welfare. That comes, we don't always get it right, we sometimes make mistakes and we think we're doing something that's good for us when it's not. But still, the intention is that we're looking after ourselves. And that comes kind of pretty natural. At least it comes natural for me. And then, as Prabhupada talks about skin disease, that the next people it's relatively easy to look after their welfare are your family members. And but it's interesting, skin disease is interesting, because in the Grihastha ashram, you're not... you know, the husband and wife, they're not blood relatives, or at least they shouldn't be, but we'll just assume that as a general as a general rule, they're not blood relatives. So that may start out so wonderful, but oftentimes it turns out not to be so wonderful, as we heard yesterday in Hari Suri Prabhu's class, and he was talking about Prabhupada's pastime of tea or me. And apparently Prabhupada's wife, as you heard yesterday, thought he was joking. And next thing, she didn't see him for 7 years. So I guess she figured out it wasn't a joke after some time. But the attachment for the children is still strong, because they are blood connected. But of course, sometimes the attachment between the husband and wife wanes a little bit. So it's easy, it's relatively easy for us to look after ourselves and be interested in ourselves. But even close family members, like husband, wife, and sometimes even actually blood relatives, you get, you know, fallouts between parents and children and all that kind of stuff. this Shema Darshina can even be difficult for that, for those relationships. Now, what to speak of the people in general? The people in general having this mood of caring for their welfare. You know, I'm sure we've all driven from Mayapur to Calcutta Airport to the most wonderfully named airport in the world, you know, Dum Dum Airport. You know, for native English speakers, that's an incredible name to, it's almost like saying, you know, the airport with no air traffic controllers, you know, or something of that nature. Anyway, it's quite interesting. anyways, and you may be a little late for your flight. You've left it a little late or some, there's some complication. And then there's a traffic jam or there's some dispute on the road and some people are having some dispute. For your heart to be Shema Darshina, considering their well, at least for me, it's just get out of the way. I'm trying to catch my flight, you know. But to have shame or darshana for these people like that. But the politicians, as I understand it, they pretend that they do. And I understand that the most common phrase during elections in West Bengal, the most common phrase that the politicians will use, how many native Bengali speakers do we have in the room? We have no native Bengali speakers in the room? Oh, what? Okay. Ah, we have a few. You obviously don't speak English so good, huh? Anyways, I understand that the most common phrase in West Bengal during election time by the politicians is Dekchi, 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 Dekchi. For those who don't speak Bengali, Dekchi or Dekchi means let's see, let's see. So what happens is the politicians are doing their campaigns and they're on the back of trucks or whatever it is, and people are coming up to shake their hands. But some people, most people when they come, they will say, what about the road? The road needs fixed. Or what about the school? We don't have proper facilities in the school. Or what about the hospital? We don't have a hospital, you know. And the politicians will go, Dekchi, Dekchi, Dekchi. Yeah. In other words, there is not a snowball's chance in hell that they're going to give you what you want. But they can't say that because they want your vote. So it's Dekchi, 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 Dekchi. Give me your votes and Dekchi, Dekchi. So this is the modern day version of Shema Darshina. Dekchi, Dekchi. Let's see, let's see. I remember not so many years ago, but the story is of many, many years ago, that we talk about corruption and oftentimes among politicians, and oftentimes we talk about corruption in West Bengal. But actually, corruption's everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere. Just in different parts of the world, they're kind of better at covering it up and that kind of stuff. Anyway, for the last 30 years in Ireland, there's been tribunals, official government-sponsored tribunals, to uncover all the corruption that was going on over the last 50, 60 years. People taking, particularly in planning, people taking bribes to rezone land and all that kind of stuff. And one of the main politicians, not now, at the time, one of the main politicians who was the focus of these tribunals, his name, if any of you are interested, was Charles Haughey, was his name. And he was really the focus. Basically, he was a really corrupt guy, although he was kind of one of these benevolent guys that was kind of nice to people. But basically, he was, you know, taking huge amounts of money, you know, from big businessmen and all that kind of stuff. So at the height of it, when the decision was coming as to whether he was innocent or guilty, they did one of these vox populis on the street, and they asked people of their opinion of, you know, what do you think, you know? And of course some people, we should bring back the death penalty. We should hang him. We should send him over to France and give him the guillotine, you know? But then you have the more sort of quote-unquote innocent people, and I just remember they asked this sort of 70-year-old woman, you know, like kind of granny, like woman like that, you know? And they said to her, what do you think should happen to him, you know? She says, oh, I think Charles is a great man. I remember in the 60s when he became Minister for Health, he gave everybody a free toothbrush. And this, you know, so he took, you know, maybe conservatively 10 million euros over, I think was the guesstimate, 10 million euros in bribes, but he gave everybody a free toothbrush. So he's a nice guy. He's a good guy. So it's just interesting how Prabhupada uses this phrase so many times. The cheaters and the cheated. Like that. You cannot have the cheats without the cheated, and you cannot have the cheated without the cheats. They go hand in glove. And in an absolute sense, we shouldn't really make any distinction between the two. And we shouldn't become bewildered or confused by them like that. So I didn't really mean to speak all that I've just spoken, so I apologize for that. It just came to my, the thoughts just came like that. But of course, this is a very serious subject matter, an extremely serious subject matter about having qualified leaders of society, people who are actually qualified to lead. Because if they're qualified to lead, then following them will be glorious. And it says here that these great Shema Darshinas, that what are they doing? They're always thinking how to elevate people of the universe to the spiritual platform. This is what they're thinking, and this is what their motivation is, because this, as we know, is the ultimate welfare for everybody in society. And it's so important, because why? Because there are so many billions of illusions for us to fall into. So this lady in Ireland was falling into the illusion that if a politician gives you a free toothbrush, he's a Shema Darshina. That was her illusion. But you look around the world in these different countries. Look at a country I think not so far away from here, North Korea. How the people, they just worship these, basically they're just worshiping these demons. They're just worshiping them. It's quite amazing. People who are just practically exclusively out for their own interests, and people are just worshiping them. It's quite an extraordinary phenomena in our world, you know, that people are so easily misled and so easily cheated. So, as a consequence of that, it's so important to have this Shema Darshina. And then quotes the Chaturvarnya Maharshi Stam verse. Of course, this is interesting, and in the purport, Prabhupada says it so simply, you know. In every class, in every society, there must be an intelligent class, administrative, productive class, worker class. Of course, we know how much in ISKCON that we have this discussion and this debate, it's a continual discussion and debate as to how best to implement the system of Varna and Ashram within our society. But in essence, and we have to pray to Krishna, we have to pray hard for him to give us the intelligence, Tesham Satata Yuktanam, to give us the intelligence from within to understand what our role is. We can also take advice from others. Of course, we have to try to seek out people who are at least on the path of being Shema Darshina to get their advice. But a combination of praying to Krishna to give us the intelligence and taking advice from people who are on the progressive path to being Shema Darshinas, we have to try and figure out what our role is in the Varna Ashram system. Because if we don't get it right, then as Prabhupada's saying here, of course he's blaming it on modern democracy, these scientific divisions are turned topsy-turvy. But it's not just by modern democracy, they can also be turned topsy-turvy by us being Vaishyas and thinking that we're Brahmins, or that we're Brahmins and we're thinking that we're Sudras or Kshatriyas and thinking that we're Vaishyas or whatever it may be. So, a combination of praying hard to Krishna for that intelligence to understand, and also taking the advice of people who have some ability to give us that advice is very, very important. And what's the goal? We know these wonderful verses from Srimad Bhagavatam, Toktar Swaradhanam, you know, what if their goal is Samsadhir Hari Toshanam, their goal is to worship the Supreme Person, to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead, if that's their goal, then even if they don't perform their duties according to the Varnashram system perfectly, then that will be okay. On the other hand, if they perform their duties perfectly, but that isn't the goal that they have, or at least it's not properly aligned, then what use is that? Or as the Christians say, you know, what use if you gain the entire world, but you lose your eternal soul like that? The other verse I was thinking of, Devarshi Bhutapa Ninam Pichinam, that if you are properly situated, and have that goal clearly in mind, and that is the direction that you're going in, without any tinge of, or at least you're not acting on any tinge of self-interest, and you are on the path of Shema Darshina, then actually you have no obligation to society. There is no obligation to society, family, friends, etc. You've no obligation because you're properly situated in Krishna consciousness. At the same time, we have to be, if we're going to disregard all our Varna and Ashram responsibilities, all our familial responsibilities like that, then we have to not only be certain that we're on that path and on that platform, we have to be certain that we're going to stay on that path and stay on that platform. Otherwise, we're going to create havoc both for ourselves and in society in general. So what's the price to pay for this? What is the price to pay for being, if that's the right way to put it, for being able to reject those social and, if you like, material responsibilities? What's the actual price that we have to pay? We have to effectively be off the bodily platform. We have to be in control of our false ego. We have to effectively have controlled lust. I mean, that's what really it comes down to. We have to have controlled our lust. We have to have turned it into love, because it's coming from the same source. Love and lust is coming from the same source. A few days ago, we celebrated Ram Nomi. And of course, Ravan is the embodiment of lust. He wanted to steal Sita. Why? To enjoy Sita. And of course, all of the devotees, and Hanuman and all his army, etc., what were they doing? They were on the platform of love, love for Krishna, love for Ram, and they were trying to win back Sita, not for their own enjoyment, but for the enjoyment of Ram, like that. So this is the platform that we have to aspire to and come to if we're going to renounce and reject all of those social responsibilities that we have. And just like in that pastime, when Ravan's getting his head chopped off, what actually happens? What actually happens when he gets his head chopped off? Yeah, they come back. And just in the analogy of anartas, it's kind of very interesting that, you know, we may sometimes feel that we've dealt with some anarta, something that we've been struggling with for a period of time, and we're praying to Krishna, we're engaged in our sadhana very nicely, in our service very nicely, and we may feel that we've actually conquered that particular anarta. But of course, as soon as we conquer that anarta, suddenly another one pops up that we may not even have thought of before or had much kind of a connection to before, and another one pops up, and it's very much like that, the chopping of the heads of Ravan, and another one popping up. So it's a constant kind of battle and a constant endeavor to come in control of these the anartas that are actually there. And what can actually overcome it in the end? What deals with it in the end? So in the pastime of Lord Ramachandra, it was the arrow of Ram, as we saw as part of a subsection of the drama this year, Bhakti Marg Swami's drama, that I see Abhay Prabhu sitting here, who was a very wonderful participant in, and they very nicely showed that, the arrow shooting into the heart of Ravan. And then the heads were gone, and there were no more heads popping up, there were no more anartas. So that's what we require. We require that arrow of Krishna, or that arrow of Ram, to destroy all of the anartas that are sitting within our hearts. And if we don't do that, both as followers, naturally as leaders, that's a given, we understand that. Prabhupada is so heavy throughout all of his Bhaktivedanta purports about the responsibility of leaders. You know, they assume one-sixth, the leader assumes one-sixth, I think he says, of the karma of the citizens. So in India, if we do a rough calculation of that, you know, what's his name, the Prime Minister Singh, is it? Singh, Mahaman Singh or something? That, you know, he now has to assume the karma of somewhere in the region of 220 million people. That's what he's got coming to him. We will pray for him whenever he steps out of office. But that's it. That's the seriousness of it. You know, a sixth of the karma of the population of any given country. So it's a very, very serious business. And you know, Prabhupada uses these words like it's an onerous responsibility. And why is it an onerous responsibility? Because if you don't live up to that responsibility, if you're putting yourself in that role and you're not living up to that responsibility, then you will be dealt with by the stringent laws of material nature. And that word is just such a lovely English word, you know. As you speak it, it's almost like, you know, when you're a kid and you'd be getting bullied in school. I always got bullied. I never did the bullying, you know. That's why I spontaneously related to, you know, getting bullied as opposed to being the bully. But anyway, you know that Chinese burn thing they used to do where they would turn the arm, one hand turns one way and one hand turns the other way? And as they turned, the further the person's, I can't do it, as the further the two hands, you know, are going away from each other, the more painful it is. That's kind of, that describes the word stringent very nicely. You know, the more that pain is coming, you know, the stringent laws of material nature. So these are all the responsibilities that particularly the leaders have, but also we all have it. We all have it. Another part of the Bhagavad, in the third canto, I think, of the Srimad Bhagavatam, or is it maybe in the fourth canto, Prabhupada talks extensively about if the citizens are unhappy, if they're actually unhappy, the citizens are unhappy, that's the fault of the leaders. That's the fault of the leaders, you know, the citizens are unhappy. However, as devotees, karmana deva netrena, we understand that, you know, whatever we're receiving, that karmic reaction that we're receiving, that's actually our own responsibility. So we can focus on leaders about their responsibility and what's come from them, but individually we also focus on ourselves. And we all have that responsibility because we're all leaders for ourselves, we're all leaders for our family unit, or whatever it may be, we're all leaders for that, that we focus on our responsibilities. And of course, our duty also is to make it more easy for the leaders to function in their roles by us functioning properly, properly in our roles like that. So, yeah, it's an onerous responsibility. So we have to decide. You know, in the pastime with Lord Chaitanya and Ramananda Roy, when he's rejecting, Lord Chaitanya's rejecting different. It's interesting in that pastime actually, because at one point it's presented that Bhagavad Gita 1854 is superior to, it's a superior position to Bhagavad Gita 1866. So the Brahma-Bhuta Prasanatma is a superior platform to the Sarva-Dharma Pritya-Jha verse. But of course then Prabhupada explains that it's, Ramananda Roy is not presenting the Sarva-Dharma Pritya-Jha verse in that context, but more in the context of renunciation, chag, like that. So anyway, that's just in the context that Varnashram was rejected. So as devotees, sometimes we can be a little glib maybe about that. Well, you know, Lord Chaitanya said, Varnashram, like that. But for us to do that, you know, it really does require that we're understanding, you know, that we're on the progressive path of Shema Darshana, that we have the welfare of all others foremost in our minds, like that, before we're rejecting any of these social structures or orders of life, like that. And the four Kumaras did it. They did it, made Lord Brahma extremely angry because he wanted them to procreate. So he made Lord Brahma extremely angry, but they did that. They did, and they were the epitome, if you like, of that verse, Devashi Bhutapta Nirnam Pichunam, that they could, because they were properly situated. And of course the four Kumaras didn't revert on that, they continued that perfect life. And it's explained in that pastime that Lord Brahma, he became extremely angry, that's when Rudra manifests from him. And extremely angry because of that. And Prabhupada's explaining how that's our challenge. Our challenge is to overcome these lower qualities of lust and anger, to actually properly overcome them. And Prabhupada explains and what's our choice? What's our choice? I can't remember who gave class here the other day. Somebody gave class and they were making that point that it's coming to all of us. It's actually coming to all of us. Death is coming to all of us. So what's our choice? I can remember as a young boy, lying awake, I can't remember exactly what age I was, I think my early teens, that kind of thing, and lying awake at night, meditating on the concept of eternality and the fact that I don't feel eternal, because I was obviously identifying with the temporary body, but trying to meditate on this concept of eternality. And eternality, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, means without beginning and without end. There is no beginning and there's no end. At that point in time, when I was a teenager, I was just really focusing on the without end aspect of it. And that's such a daunting, as a non-devotee, it's such a daunting prospect. Without eternality, there is no end. We exist forever like that. So, but as devotees, we understand that, and we understand that time for the non-devotee is such a fearful thing, but for the devotee, it's liberation. That should be an impetus for us, something to inspire us in our devotional life. You know, that this is temporary, the situation we're in is temporary, and we have to leave it. We have to leave it. I remember listening to a class here last year where it was being nicely described that what are we leaving when we're leaving the body? What is it that we're leaving? We leave the body, of course, and the mind. That the mind is the sitting place of the senses, and the body is the facility for engaging those senses of touch, taste, and all those sight, hearing, etc. So we're leaving behind the senses. Now, that identification with the senses is so strong, and certainly for non-devotees, and to whatever degree for devotees, it's actually our exclusive relationship that we have with the world. And that we have almost with ourselves is identification with the senses. There is almost nothing else. There is nothing else for non-devotees, and then for devotees, depending on the level of advancement that we've achieved, to that varying degree, that identification and an attachment to the senses is decreasing, or vice versa, to the degree that we're not advancing or haven't advanced, that identification with the senses is still extremely strong. So what does death mean? Death means that we, the real we, the person we really are, is leaving all that behind. And if all we've experienced in life and all we've identified in life with are those senses, just consider how painful that is. How painful it's going to be. It's going to be like extremely painful. I mean, anyone ever have the experience of, you know, one time I lost, somebody had given me, it was actually they'd given for me to bring back to the West actually, so I was doing somebody a favor. And I was on one of these flights that stays over, I think it was in Bahrain, stays over 24 hours or something, and they give you a hotel room to stay in as part of the flight that you take, you know. And somebody had given me $1,000 to bring back from here to... And when I was in the hotel, I locked the money in one of those safes that they have in the hotel. I locked it in the safe, you know, and I forgot it. Next day, I walked out. And your whole meditation on the flight back from Bahrain to London, you know, your whole meditation is, God, I've left that $1,000. And I said, oh no, what am I going to do, you know? I've lost $1,000. I'm going to have to compensate that. You know? And that's your whole meditation. You're feeling this pain of separation from this $1,000. You even start thinking, maybe I can get a cheap flight back to Bahrain, you know, that will be less than $1,000, and I'll be able to go back and at least get recover $100, $200, $300 or something like that. But anyway, the point is, you lose that. You're separated from that $1,000, and it just becomes a real focus of meditation. But that's just an external thing. Money, it's just an external thing. Can you imagine the pain of separation, depending on how much we're attached to the material body and the material senses, it's going to be at the time of death? It's going to be absolutely excruciating and quite devastating. So Prabhupada is stressing that, and he stresses that, of course, in the pastime of Prahlad Maharaj, that, you know, we should never waste a moment. We should always be. Real philosophy means to always keep death right in front of you. That's real philosophy. How many times have you ever said that to a non-devotee, you know, and they'll turn, oh, it's really morbid. It's not really morbid at all, you know. It's actually really, really positive to keep death always in front of you. So you're ready for it. You're ready for when it's coming, because it is coming, you know. For any one of us, it may be a minute, 5 minutes, a day, a week, a year, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years. Who knows? But it's absolutely definitely coming. A nice example, I don't think it's a Prabhupada example, but I think it's a really nice example, is, and I've given it before, so excuse me if you've heard me speak this one before, but in the 70s, there was a lovely Shema Darshina, who went by the name of Augusto Pinochet, was his name. And he was in charge of a country called Chile, which, despite its name, is quite a hot country, but anyway. And he was in charge of that country from 1973 to 1990. And one of his favorite pastimes, Augusto Pinochet's pastimes, was, and can you imagine if you're in charge of a country, you control the army, you control the police, you control everything. Any of you ever have an experience with another living entity, particularly a human living entity, when they annoy you, when they frustrate you, when they irritate you, when they just downright absolutely make you feel really angry? You ever had that experience? Could you imagine if you're in charge of a country and you could just tell one of your right-hand men, take that person, actually not just that person, but there's 1,000 people that have done this to me, take these 1,000 people, take them out into one of those nice big aircraft carriers that carry all those big machinery, but don't put any machinery in, just put the 1,000 people in, fly it out halfway over the Atlantic Ocean or the Pacific Ocean from Chile to Hawaii, open the door and throw them all out. You know, what an incredible way of dealing with the consequences or the result of your anartas. In other words, you have these anartas and they are provoked by certain people doing certain things, and instead of dealing with the anarta, you just deal with the external. But if you are doing that, what a wonderful way to do it, you know, just throw them all in an airplane, out over the ocean, throw them out. Anyway, I'm not recommending that as a policy to be adopted by the leaders in ISKCON. It's too expensive. We don't have the airplanes. Maybe we'll just, drive them to a bridge over the Ganga and throw them in. At least it's the Ganga. It's better than the Pacific Ocean. Anyways, so what a wonderful, wonderful way to deal with your enemies or people that frustrate you. But I was thinking when I was learning about Augusto Pinochet, I was thinking that, can you imagine in that situation that you've just been thrown out of the airplane? I think they didn't used to fly so high for two reasons. I think one, because they didn't want to waste fuel, and two, if you fly too high, then when you throw the people out, they die on the way down. But if you don't fly so high, they actually have to hit the ocean, the freezing cold water, and then they also go through the additional suffering of being freezing cold and drowning. So just to add to their suffering, I think they used to fly quite low, maybe 5,000 feet or 10,000 feet or something like that. But can you imagine if you're one of those people, and as you're falling out of that airplane and you're falling down towards your guaranteed death, and you know that. So now you know, I don't know how long it takes to fall from 10,000 feet. Anybody ever do any skydiving or anything like that? But if you've done any skydiving, you have. How long does it take to fall from 10,000 feet, approximately? 10, 20 minutes. Wow, it's a long time. 12. 10, 12 minutes. 10, 12 minutes. Enough time to have your final sandwich. You know, if you've packed a final sandwich with you, you know, you can have it on the way down. But can you imagine you're falling down to your absolute guaranteed death and you've got another 10 minutes. Now you know, like Maharaj Pariksit had 7 days. Now you actually know you have 10 minutes left to die. And there's another 1,000 people falling with you. Can you imagine as you're falling and you just happen to be falling at the same ratio or the same velocity as somebody else, and you just happen to know them. They're one of your neighbors from the estate that you live in, and you think, ah, Mr. Give us a Spanish name, Mr. Alfonso. Ah, yeah. Give me a first name now. Mr. Carlos. Carlos. Ah, Carlos. Hey, how's it going, Carlos? And I said, not too bad, not too bad. You know, I'm going on a holiday to the Seychelles next week with the family. Haven't been on a holiday for over 5 years. And, you know, so we're going on holiday in a couple of weeks. Looking forward to that. And, you know, my son just graduated from college, so he's going to get a good job, be able to help us out financially. So when we come back from holidays, I won't have to work so hard. I tell you, life is fantastic. It's really rosy at the minute. Couldn't be going better. How's it going for you? So, me fantastic. You know what happened to me yesterday? I won the lotto. Wow, you won the lotto, fantastic. Wow, things are even going better for you than they're going for me. And then as they're having this conversation, what happens? Splat. Dead, gone, over, like that. But isn't that amazing? That from the time that we take birth in the material world, from the very time that we take birth in the material world, we're falling to that guaranteed death, to that splat. Splat. You know that splat when something falls from a high distance and hits the ground and it looks really messy? Splat. That's what's happening. Now, you know, Prabhu told us 10 or 12 minutes. So we may be a minute into that descent. We may be 5 minutes into that descent. We may be 11 and a half minutes in that descent. We may be 11 minutes 59 and a half seconds into that descent. And splat is inevitable. But how many times today will we have a relatively useless conversation? A relatively unimportant, useless conversation about something like, you know, didn't see them at Mangal Arati today. That's the fifth time this year I haven't seen them at Mangal Arati. Shall we start a campaign to have them removed from Mayapur? Shall we get the XYZ police after them? Or whatever the conversation may be, you know. Didn't think Prasadam was so good today. It was only 3 vegetable subjis and 2 paneer subjis. When I spend my 20 rupees, I expect there to be at least 3 paneer subjis when I'm taking my prasadam. So, you know, how many useless conversations will I have today? After this class, if I have any, I'll be in big trouble. But I'm going to stop there, because I'm going to stop there. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Yes, Prabhu. Now, what's happening here, just in case you're not aware, this Prabhu is saying maybe a small Sankirtan story, okay? This is something that happens to me regularly, and this is something that really helps with controlling your false ego. And I really hope that everybody else in the room is listening to what I'm saying now, okay? I am not the Pragoshtas. I am a Pragoshtas. And I presume, I could be wrong, but I'm presuming that question from that Prabhu is because there is a certain devotee called Pragoshtas, disciple of Srila Prabhupada, who was a wonderful book distributor. But that is not me. But funnily enough, I can still tell you a Sankirtan story. But I'm not going to. Any other questions or comments? yes, Prabhu.
In this purport, democracy comes off looking pretty bad.
Who comes off pretty bad?
Democracy.
Yeah.
And sometimes he calls it demon crazy. But we've also heard that that's the system that he chose for the GBC to elect to make their decisions, is democracy. Is democracy not always demon crazy? Or what is there a different democracy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The demon crazy reference is very much in the... I love these questions, by the way. I really thank you for asking that question. I love these kind of social, organizational questions, you know. If you'd ask me, you know, can you describe the difference between, you know, the parakeya rasa that so-and-so has with Krishna and whatever, then it's like... I love these questions. So, my understanding is demon crazy particularly refers to the fact that when you have quote-unquote unqualified people voting unqualified people into positions of power and authority, like that, that's when democracy becomes demon crazy. But actually, when some devotees, now I may not get all the details of this correct, a long time since I read it, but when some devotees, it was in New Vrindavan, they were really pushing for a monarchy in New Vrindavan, really pushing Prabhupada hard for a monarchy in New Vrindavan. And I'm not sure, and I better not mention names because I could do somebody a disservice and that's not fair. I'm not quite sure who was pushing who. I kind of think I know, but I better not, just in case I get it wrong. But anyway, certain devotees were pushing hard for a monarchy in New Vrindavan on the point that you've just raised. But Prabhupada, you say the democracy is useless, demon crazy, and monarchy is the best form of management or leadership or authority. And Prabhupada quite clearly says in that conversation, no. He says, right now, democracy is the best system that we have. Until we have qualified people who can take the role of monarch, democracy is the best system that we have. It's the best of a bad bargain, and that's what, therefore we should have it. So in ISKCON, our understanding is, and you mentioned, I don't know if everybody heard, Prabhu mentioned the GBC. The GBC doesn't completely function democratically. You'll be interested to know. In the context that as a body, it functions democratically, in terms of how it votes, and therefore the majority vote, because it has different checks and balances built into that, but in essence it votes as a democracy. Although, I have to stress, as a member of the GBC body, that they're always striving to achieve consensus like that. But ultimately, yes, if it comes down to it, the majority will decide what way to go. So in that sense, they function like a democracy. But of course, how they're elected and how they're nominated as GBCs isn't done exclusively in a democratic way. It's done more in a consultative way. So, as Harry Sawyer was explaining yesterday, there are many different systems of monarchy even. There's absolute monarchy, there's constitutional monarchy, etc. So, in the same way, there's elements of democracy that the GBC adopt, but it's not an exclusively pure democratic system that we would have, because it's complicated. You know, Prabhupada also was not averse to temple presidents being elected. But the complication with it is, and it requires resources and thought and all that kind of stuff, you know, and we're lacking on resources. I'm not saying we're lacking on thought. I think I was going to say we're very lacking on those, thought. But, you know, it requires resources particularly. But who votes, particularly in our modern ISKCON? In the 70s and early 80s, it was a little easier because practically everybody lived in a temple. Everybody was going to the morning program, or else you had the XYZ police on your case. So, you know, it was easier. Everybody could have a vote. But in our modern system, hey, you know, 96%, and this is apparently an accurate statistic because devotees have done research on this, particularly in the UK, 96% of our ISKCON devotees are congregationally based. Only 4% are ashram based. Can you imagine that? We've 96% of our organization are fringes. Do you remember that? If it was in the 70s, they'd all be fringes. Fringes. Now we can't call them fringes anymore because of 96% of them. We have a bit of a problem, you know? So we have to be nice to them now, you know, congregational devotees. I am joking, of course. I'm a congregational devotee myself. Or actually, I'm not. I'm a fringy. But anyway, that's another story. So 96%. So how do you create, you know, an electrical system? What do you base it on? Who's qualified to vote? Who's not qualified? Is it 4 regs, 16 rounds? Is it 3 regs, 8 rounds? You know, is it one reg and no round? Is it one round and no regs? I mean, how do you decide, you know, who actually has the vote? Do you bring the local butcher in? Does he get a vote who the TP is? You know, it becomes really kind of complicated, actually. So we don't have a system of electing temple presidents. But the GBC is actually, there's more of an election process, because when new GBCs are brought onto the body, then leadership in the local areas are consulted. The regional councils, national councils, etc., temple presidents, they're consulted about it. So it's not a pure democratic system. But in terms of democracy getting a hard time here, Unfortunately, this is directed at the sweet little old lady that has just been told that your ex-prime minister embezzled at least 10 million euros, and your response is, ah, but he's a lovely fella because he gave me a free toothbrush. That's what Prabhupada is lambasting in this purport, you know, this crazy system where unqualified people are voting more unqualified people into power. At least that's my understanding of it. Madhaji, do we have the microphone for that lady?
Srimad Bhagavatam, how these great kings always turn their backs on their families and their responsibilities, and they head out into the forest and, you know, become detached from their family and everything else. And how does it affect women? You know, should we also be looking to become really renounced from our family? Because obviously as ladies, obviously we're there to look after our husband and our children. Do we hang around looking after them despite the fact they might be fallen, they're not nice devotees, they might not be devotees at all? Should we stick with our duty as a mother, as a wife? Or should we also be heading, trying to look for renunciation and leaving them, like Prabhupada left his family, and there was all, you know, you could say, was that good or was that bad? There's arguments both ways. So should we also be like Prabhupada and just turn our back on our families?
By the way, just because you mentioned that story, I should mention the point that Prabhupada did in his will actually leave property for his, you know, maternal, if that's the right word, when his family members, he actually left property in Calcutta for them, just as a point of information. It's the same for all of us. I don't see a distinction, actually. You know, we all are duty bound. These great kings do it, but usually there's two things in place. One is they're qualified to do it. They are actually detached like that. And they don't fall back, you know. Not that, you know, you read in the next chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and so-and-so Maharaj, then he met a new Bhaktin, you know, at the Rathayatra festival the next year, you know, and now he's married to her and he's looking forward to having a nice new family life. You know? Generally, you don't read that, you know, in the Bhagavatam, at least I've never read it, you know. So it's very important that they're qualified to do that, to leave behind family. And that's, they were the verses I was quoting earlier, you know, Bhagavatam endorses that 100%. If you're qualified, you can do that. The other thing that they normally do is they leave provision behind for those family members to be properly catered for. But the simple fact of the matter is that whether they do renounce like that or whether they don't, we all have to renounce at the time of death, including the wives and including the children. It just has to be done. So, you know, how it's done depends on our qualification at any given point in time in our progress through life and our progress in spiritual life. And I don't see a distinction between, you know, between men and women in that regard. Culturally, socially, there are distinctions, and there are differences. Generally, we see the examples in Bhagavatam that there are differences. But on an absolute platform, you know, if the renunciation is there and it's complete, then, you know, I don't see a distinction. Vipada Shantu Na Yashvat. If you're on the platform of Queen Kunti, and you're just asking for more calamities to come to you, if that's your platform, you know, then you're qualified to be renouncing, you know, your social obligations in the material world. You're definitely qualified to do that. That all the problems come, and maybe I'll finish on this note, because I have a meeting at 9 o'clock, but anyway, that's another thing. But I'll finish on this note, that if you're on that platform, you're qualified to renounce, absolutely. But I would say for you, for me, and for everybody else, you're always safer to err on the side of caution. And better that you are qualified to renounce but actually delay in doing it rather than prematurely doing it and then discovering, actually, I wasn't quite as renounced as I thought I was, you know? Because that's much more problematic than being qualified and being properly renounced but remaining in your situation for a longer period of time. In Prabhupada's life, the impression that I get from Prabhupada's life was that he got his instruction in 1922 from Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, but he didn't actually affect it till like 40 years later, there or thereabouts, when he actually came to the West. But in terms of his own personal qualification, I don't think any of us would doubt that he could have enacted it right there and then when Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj gave him the instruction. But for whatever reason, it didn't happen then, happened 40 years later. So delaying, even though you're qualified, is a much safer, better thing to do than jumping into this renunciation when we might not be qualified. And take Prabhupada's example. How many of us have been chanting Hare Krishna for 40 years? How many devotees in this room have been chanting Hare Krishna for 40 years? Not one. I have to say that Yanag Yamya Prabhu has been chanting Hare Krishna for 39 years. No, not at all. Yanag Yamya Prabhu ki. 39 years. And of course, we have somebody else in the room who is just, you know, manifesting those qualifications to, you know, renounce all social and ISKCON obligations because he didn't raise his hands. We have, of course, Janani Vas Prabhu. Janani Vas Prabhu ki. Yeah. So, aside from those two, now somebody else will put their hand up, you know? Okay, you as well. Okay, aside from those three, and then somebody else. aside from all that. Anyway, aside from those two, nobody else has been chanting Hare Krishna for 40 years. Yet Prabhupada didn't actually act on his instruction of his spiritual master for 40 years. In that sense, there is no panic. How many of us in this room are 69 years of age? Now, even if you were, you wouldn't put your hand up, right? Particularly the ladies. I'm sorry. Particularly the unrenounced ladies. Anyway, so none of us are 69 years of age, okay? Now, in the last time, you know, Ganagamipu put his hand up just a little bit to let me know, 39, I'm nearly there. So I don't see any hands going up, you know. Well, you know, I'm 67 and a half. I'm nearly there. I don't see that. Anyway, Prabhupada left Radha Damodar, we heard yesterday, temple. 69 years of age is when Prabhupada left to start the Hare Krishna movement. He spent at least a year in the most bizarre circumstances on the Bari. You know, really bizarre circumstances that Prabhupada actually initially, and then in Dr. Mishra's ashram. Now really, I mean really wacky stuff actually, the people that he was associating with, you know. And it describes how he, you know, he's going to the local store to get some vegetables to cook his daily meal, you know, and with the wind chill factor, it's minus 30 degrees. He's like come from Vrindavan, you know, minus 30 degrees, and he's wearing sannyas cloth, you know. So the external difficulties, the association, that famous one where he has that little section in some room in the Bari, and it's only partitioned off with a curtain. And a reporter comes to see him, wants to talk to him, and the reporter makes his, it's a room, say, this big, I don't know exactly how big it is, and it's all partitioned off, and all people have they're living there or have their different kind of practices there. So you've got all these weird yogis, you know, and these pseudo-American kind of yogis, and you've got, like, most of the people are taking LSD, you know, and it's just a wacky scene, you know. And the reporter comes in and makes his way through all of these people and eventually finds Prabhupada in one corner, you know. And the first question he asks Prabhupada, he says, oh, these are all your followers? And Prabhupada says, I have absolutely nothing to do with them. So, you know, these are the circumstances that Prabhupada was in when he came. And this is 69 years of age. So that whole year, so he was 70 before he started making any really inroads in starting the Hare Krishna movement. And none of us are that age yet. So what's the hurry? What's the hurry for, you know, a 30-something mother with children of, you know, 15 and 16 to go, oh, you know, I want to renounce it all. I just want to wear Radha Kund Tilak, you know, and bathe in the Ganga all day and meditate on the pastimes of Lord Gauranga. You know, where does that come from? You know, whose example's that? You know, it's like, wow, you know. And then 2 years later, you know, the same person is in therapy, you know, because it's, you know, she's got difficulties with, I don't know, whatever the difficulties may be. So, you know, let's err on the side of caution. Even if we feel super renounced, let's be so renounced, that we stick with our social responsibilities for a few years longer. Because we're able to, because we are so renounced, nothing will throw us off course. Rather than, you know, immediately throwing on the saffron lungi, you know, and the whatever else, and hey, look at me, I'm so renounced. You know. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki.
Just wait. You'll wake up one morning and find